I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas. It is the last Wednesday of the month, which means it's The Stacks Book Club Day. We're joined again by Nicole Perkins, the author of Sometimes I Trip on How Happy We Could Be, to discuss the 1992 classic, Waiting to Exhale by Terry McMillan. There are some minor spoilers in this episode. And be sure to listen to the end of today's episode to find out what our book club pick will be for November. If you're looking for even more from The Stacks, you can check us out over on Patreon. You can get bonus episodes, a Discord community, The Stacks Virtual Book Club, and coming very soon, the 2022 Stacks Reading Tracker. For more information, head to patreon.com/thestacks. And I do want to take a quick moment to thank our latest members of The Stacks Pack, Sophie Peterson, Megan Pearson, Miriam Kaba, Brenda Barry, Zakiya Cowan, Leah Connor, Laura Schoberg, and Aaron Nuttall. I really could not make this show without you and all of the rest of the Stacks Pack, so thank you so much. Okay, now it's time to get into this month's book club pick, Waiting to Exhale, with our guest, Nicole Perkins. Okay, everybody, it is time for the October book club conversation. We have brought back the wonderful Nicole Perkins. Nicole, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back. I'm really excited for this episode because I cannot wait to talk about today's book.
I'm so excited. So today's book, for those of you who decided to press play on something without even reading the title of the episode, is Waiting to Exhale by Terry McMillan, the 1992 classic. I think it's a classic at this point.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. For sure. Okay. So there probably will be some spoilers if you haven't read the book. But if you don't care, go ahead and listen. If you do care, hit pause, read the book, come back. We'll be here waiting for you. Nicole, we always start the book club episodes pretty much exactly the same, which is, what did you think of the book?
Okay, so I still really enjoyed the book, but all, you know, reading it as an adult in 2021, I was just like, ooh, that's a little cringy. But I was just like, wow, Terry McMillan knew what she was doing with this book. Like, it was just, it was a really meaty book. And when I say meaty, I just mean like all the women had solid stories with them. And even though they were going through something different, I mean, they were going through a lot of similar things, they all had like brought a different like flavor to it. So I was just, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the book. I enjoyed it overall.
I feel like I come down sort of in a similar place, which is, but this was my first time ever reading the book or seeing the movie, which I know, like I had seen the scene with Angela Bassett 1,000 times, right. You know, the gif is everywhere, you know, but I was sort of like, what is this book going to be? And I think that it has aged well in some ways and then aged terribly in other ways. And I found that to be really interesting. But I think, like you're saying, the meat of the book, like the women and their relationships and the way that Terry McMillan has like four really fleshed out characters, I think that that is really impressive. And for them to still feel super relevant almost 30 years later, like that right. is really, really impressive to me. I feel like one of the things that the book does that I was sort of like, this is a lot, is like it takes on every single issue that ever happened to Black people in the history of America, like since slavery, like aside from slavery, like it was like AIDS, homophobia, fat phobia, mental health, promiscuity, single Black women, like men ain't shit, crack, being a mistress. Like it was like anything that Black people have thought about for more than 5 seconds, like since 1965, I was like, is in this book.
That's really true. Even like gentrification, or maybe like, I don't know. I don't know if it's called reverse gentrification, but like when Black people move en masse someplace. Yes. So I remember reading this book when it first came out. I was 15 at the time. And my mom had told me to read it because it was being passed around at her job. And she, you know, she read it. I remember seeing her reading it in bed over, you know, several nights. And then she was, you know, one night she was just like, Nikki, when I'm finished with this, I want you to read it. I think you would like it. And I was like, okay, because she knew that I tend to read stuff that was like outside of my age range at the time.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I read the book and I remember just like gobbling it and just being like, oh my God, this is so good. Also because it was just like this preview into what I thought adult Black womanhood was going to be like, you know, and in a way that I wasn't getting from my relatives who weren't necessarily always going to be very open about the relationship woes that they were going through. And then when the movie came out, of course, I saw that. And that was incredible. It was so funny. And again, I also felt like I was seeing it really brought the characters to life in a certain way. And I felt more connected to them once they were on screen, because it was just like, I see my aunts and cousins, you know, with this stuff. But I'm still one of those people who is always going to think the book is better than the movie. And so there were certain things where I felt like some of the characterizations of the women kind of had to be pushed to the side, you know, for a time or whatever. But rereading it now, it's just like, ooh, this fat phobia. Like she,
oh my gosh.
It was so much. And, you know, in the movie, Gloria is played by Loretta Devine's character. You know, obviously we see her struggle with weight and what it means to be this woman who likes to cook and take care of people and the things that people say about her. But we also see her joy when the neighbor is just like, oh, well, I like me a big woman, you know, and just being, you know, being like getting in touch with your body. And I wish that Gloria had been able to reach that moment without a man having to like give that to her.
Right.
But anyway, so yeah, it was a lot of fat phobia in there to the point where I'm just like, Miss McMillan, what is going on?
Right. Because in the book, it's like even more than in the movie. I mean, in the book, it's like every other line. Like when they throw her the party and they're like, let's have a pizza party because we know she likes pizza. I was like, Jesus Christ, you guys. Like, isn't she your friend?
Right. And even the men in the book, you know, when Robin is first meeting up with Michael, and she just keeps talking about how chubby he is and how I bet he likes to eat and all this kind of stuff. And Savannah, Whitney Houston's character in the movie, when she's like goes to this party at the beginning of New Year's and she says the women are looking at her real ugly. And she's just like, don't be mad at me because I'm not fat and ugly. And it's like, okay, right. Well, well, maybe they're not. Maybe they're just looking at you because they don't know you, you know?
Right. Right.
I don't know. It's just all these different little moments. I was just like, this is unnecessary.
Do you remember at the time, like in the early mid 90s, like was talking bad about fat people like that, was that just like normal? Because a lot of me reading the book was like trying to reconcile what I feel and think now versus what I remember from the early 90s. And for me, I was like, was this in everything? Like, was everyone talking about fat people in this way? Like, I do remember Oprah was like always on her weight loss journey and it was like a thing. And I know like in pop culture, we definitely talked about weight in a way that we do not now. But like, do you have any recollection of that?
I think part of it is it was a holdover from the 80s when all of these like exercise gurus and stuff like that. And, you know, like looking back, I think it was also kind of a way for people to be like, I'm not on Coke. I just exercise a lot, you know, from the 80s.
I see.
You know, stuff like that. And but there was definitely a lot of like, what do you call it? Like exercise propaganda, you know, and like.
Right. Like there is now.
Yeah. Yeah. But now it's just worded more delicately. You know, there's just like make a lifestyle change as opposed to go on a diet, you know, that kind of stuff. So the language is different because they know that people know that like actual fat shaming is bad and it's like it's really affecting people. But they still just the message is still clear. That skinny people are beautiful, you know, whether you believe that or not, you know, but, but I definitely remember, that was definitely a part of like the atmosphere at that time. And it was just, you know, like buns of steel, exercise tapes and stuff like that. And like the holdover of Richard Simmons and, you know, his, exercise routines and like Jazzercise and Jane Fonda and all that kind of stuff. So I think this is like, even though Black people, I guess you could say, tend to appreciate curves more or whatever, it's still just like, if only if it's like the right kind of curves, right?
Sure.
And so all that to say, yes, I definitely remember having that as a part of, you know, the pop culture atmosphere at the time, but I just didn't. I clearly had forgotten how much, you know, it was a part of it. And I think also it's just, you know, Terry McMillan has always been a slim woman herself, which is not to say that the author always puts themselves into the text. But I'm wondering if there was just something maybe that she just kept, I don't know, coming back to. Because it's like in every woman's section, every time we get, you know, we rotate views. There's something about somebody being fat and unattractive or somebody being like worrying about somebody else being fat and unattractive. So it was just, it really bothered me. I was really concerned about it.
It really bothered me too. Because I'd never read the book. I mean, you're saying you didn't remember, but like it really snuck up on me because I've never heard anyone talk about it. Like I've never heard it come up. Like Waiting to Exhale is so great, but like there's a lot of weird fat stuff in there. Like there's some gross stuff about weight or food or whatever. Like, so that was, because usually I feel like with classic books, I know going in sort of what the issues are or like what the hot topics, not to bring up a 90s clothing store or anything, but like what the hot takes are around it. And so it was definitely like, wait, why is no one talking about this?
Yeah, I don't know what that is. I guess it just kind of got pushed to the side and just became Gloria's story as opposed to the way that it was threaded throughout. So yeah, it's very disturbing, actually.
Yeah. One of the things you brought up was about Terry McMillan and like not that the author is any of the characters or it's their point of view necessarily. But one of the things I found interesting as far as the writing is that Savannah and Robin are sometimes, you know, in first person, I guess, where it's like, I did this, I did that, while Gloria and Bernadine are never. And I'm wondering if you had any thoughts about like why an author might do that or like what that does for the book.
You know, I was thinking about that as I, you know, we read it because, you know, the movie, it became clear that it was Savannah's story or like, you know, she was the main one. And I always thought that it was just because Whitney Houston, right? Like, you know, she was the star, even though the other women were also very well respected at that time. But, you know, for Whitney, it was clearly her movie or whatever. But rereading it, I was just like, I realized that too. And I started to think, are Robin and Savannah Terry McMillan? You know, like, did she split herself up and it was easier for her to talk about her experiences in dating? Because, you know, obviously, you know, later we'll get how Stella got her groove back. And we're talking about this woman who has been single or, you know, dealing with heartbreak and trying to date again. And so, I mean, all of them go through that in the book, but I really do think that Savannah and Robin are kind of more of Terry, maybe in the way that she has, you know, talked about her dating experiences and stuff like that. And I also think she wanted, as a writer, I think she wanted to make these characters more sympathetic, right? Like, here are these two women who are unashamed about dating their dating lives, who are, you know, maybe they have a more sex than people think is proper or whatever, right, but they still have needs. So I think that's also part of why she wants, or she wrote them in first person more often, is so that we can be less judgmental of them. At least that's my hope.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot, because especially with Robin, because sometimes she's in first person and sometimes she's not, which I found to be like, clearly there's a choice here. This isn't just like, oh, Savannah's going to be in first person because it's easier for me to write her this way. But it's like with Robin, it was sort of back and forth. And I don't know. I definitely feel like it's Savannah's story. I feel like we start with Savannah both in the book and in the movie. But it feels so weird because Savannah is the most outsider one, you know, like she's the new one. She only knows Bernadine. Like, so that was, I don't know why she did it that way. And I don't know that it changes the book much if it's Bernie who's in first person or Gloria or whatever. Like, I feel like we get a lot of all of them, but it definitely is like a choice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe she just wanted us to be more inside the journey of trying to find a man and what that looks like for Black women. That's the only thing that I can really think of.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I guess also just like mixing it up and showing us like outside and inside. I don't know. But I found that choice in the movie to be particularly boring. I was surprised by how boring the movie was. I have to admit, like, I had to watch it in two parts because I started falling asleep. Like, to me, the best part of the movie is the fire scene, which obviously I guess everyone feels that way because it's the one you see all the time. But that happened very early in the book and the movie. And I was like, what now?
It's definitely a slow burn. And I do think that by the time we get to them, like, sitting together in Gloria's house and drinking and getting a little drunk and stuff like that, like, we needed that moment of silliness to kind of liven things up. Forest Whitaker directed the movie. So I think he was just trying to like take his time with each character or with their stories as much as he could.
Yeah.
It's funny because you talk about these highly jiffable moments now, right? In like this 21st century way of expressing how movies and TV shows have stayed with us. Cause it's like, that's kind of how you know that something has become iconic now, right? And when you have like teens and young people referencing them or using them for their social media responses and stuff.
Right.
So I'm thinking like for each woman, they have that. So obviously for Bernadine, it is the fire, her walking away from the car on fire. For Robin, it's not even really her. It is Russell, I think, when he's like shouting at her, "You raggedy bitch," when she like kicks him out, right? So it's more him. Gloria has this scene where she's like, you know, she tells the neighbor, I always forget his name from the book, but
is it Marvin?
I can't remember. Yeah. But when she's just like, "Oh, you should come over. I'm just cooking we're just having a little ham, you know," and she's like, she lists off everything that she's cooking and she walks away and she has that incredible switch in her walk. So that's something that gets jiffed. And actually, now that I'm running through this, I actually don't think that Whitney Houston has a jiffable moment from the movie.
Oh, you go jiff with a hard J, like peanut butter. I go gift. This is like the age-long debate.
I know. I say GIF because the man who, you know, invented it says it's supposed to be GIF. So I'm just trying to respect his.
I don't know him, so sorry to that man.
Everyone always gets one before it, but it's fine.
No, I like it. I like a debate, so I'm happy to be here. I can't find his name. I'm not going to read the whole book again. Gregory Hines.
Yeah. But now that I started this thought, Whitney Houston's character, Savannah, doesn't really have a GIF.
But she has the song. She has Waiting to Exhale.
Right. She has the song.
She has the song. I mean, talk about iconic soundtrack.
Yes.
Oh my God. That Brandy, Mary J. Like as it was going, I was like, well, I definitely owned the CD soundtrack. Like I owned the real compact disc, like a real 90s kid. Mm-hmm. And I feel like of all of the things from the movie besides the Bernadine scene, mm-hmm. what has held up the best is that soundtrack, right? Like that
Absolutely,
soundtrack,
yeah.
Babyface just really making things happen.
Yes. I mean, it had all the heavy hitters of the late 80s and early 90s. Shantae Moore, Mary J. Blige, you know, she sings Bernadine's theme where Not Gonna Cry. Oh, and she's, so you know, she's like, I was your secretary. I can't even say
that
the
line.
I can't say.
And your secretary.
Yeah. No, but it was such a good soundtrack, and I think it was, you know, just at that height of movie soundtracks as well. Like it was
Soul
it was
Food.
I had the CD. I had the CD for that, for Soul Food. Love Jones.
Love and Basketball.
Oh my God, Love and Basketball.
Oh my God.
All of that, like the 90s were so good for movie soundtracks. I don't know what happened. I really don't know what happened.
I don't know.
I wonder if someone's written about that. But yes, so the book, around that time in the 90s, I do remember a lot of Black people were moving to Arizona. And,
oh, really?
Weird. Yeah, because when you talked about earlier that this book had everything in it. I remember that. I remember like a lot of Black people, like, this is where you need to go. It's inexpensive. The weather's warm. You know, it's not a lot of BS. But also, and I think somebody references it, Arizona did not want to make Martin Luther King a holiday.
Yes. It comes up like 4 times in the book.
Yeah. And I think that was also a reason, like, people were being petty a little bit and just being like, I'm going to come to you, even though I don't know how that makes sense. But I think it was just like a way of like, you don't want us there, so we're going to come, kind of. Maybe that's what it was. I don't know.
Yeah, I just looked up the history of that because I remembered like knowing that Arizona had some issues with Martin Luther King Day. And I went and like looked it up. And for people who don't know this, so Martin Luther King Day was passed, I think, in 1983 by Ronald Reagan. And then it was like 1986 that the governor of Arizona was like, okay, we're going to do it. And then when he got voted out of office that next year, with the January that it was supposed to be, like 1987 or whatever, the new governor was like, no, fuck you, we're not doing this. And then a bunch of like artists and like celebrities basically pulled out of Arizona, including the Super Bowl. The NFL was like, we're not going to have the Super Bowl here anymore. And then that was supposed to be in 1992, which is when and the book takes place in like 1990 or something. Mm-hmm. And so in 1992, they pulled out and they said, we'll come back once you approve the holiday. And they approved the holiday in 1993 and the Super Bowl was there in 1996. Mm-hmm. And I just found that to be like, I feel like maybe that had come up in recent history when all that stuff was going on with Sheriff Arpaio or whatever recently in Arizona. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really know all the details. And when I looked it up, I was like, this is some crazy stuff. But I loved that that was in the book. I loved that like there was real, you know, history and like real things happening. Like, you know, in the book, they talk about Whitney Houston and like they talk about Donald Trump and Cliff Huxtable and like mm-hmm. some people... Prince comes up and some people mm-hmm. definitely aged better than others as far as like the references go. But I always love those like kind of meta moments, especially with Whitney Houston being brought up. I was like, this is incredible.
Right. I remember seeing these different references because sometimes people try not to put real historical figures in their books in order to like keep a timeless kind of thing so that you can pick it up at any point in history and like go with everything. But I really appreciated that Even though it was jam-packed with a lot of stuff, that you still have this. It's really, this book is really a time capsule.
1,000%
Of that time, for sure.
And I like that. I think it's better. I don't like time, quote unquote, timeless things, because I feel like when you try to make it timeless, then it lacks the specificity. Like, I knew exactly what I was dealing with from the first reference. I mean, it happens early. I think it's like Dick Clark comes up and like, because it's New Year's Eve and it's like, okay, great. I know where I am. I understand. And like, I also trust that what I'm being told is real, which I appreciate. I don't like it when it's like President Schmonald Schragen. I'm like, just say Ronald Reagan. Like, I hate you. You know, like we don't need this. We're adults here. Plus it gives you stuff to look up to be like, oh, who was that? Or like, what is that a reference to? Which I also really appreciate.
Yeah. I like when books make you kind of explore to find the context and make sure that you're understanding everything the way it should be understood. So I really dig that.
Yeah. I want to talk about some of the other things in this book that maybe aged well or didn't age well. I'm curious, aside from the fat phobia, which we both agree has aged very poorly, what were other things that you felt like either aged well or didn't age well in the book?
One thing that I really liked that, you know, it's stated like very early from Savannah's chapter and just kind of repeats itself throughout. But it's just like, don't settle. Like that. I think that's the overall message. And at one point, Savannah says something like, if I want something to happen, I have to make it happen. And that really resonated with me in the ways that these women had to take control of their lives. Like they were just trying to sit back and wait for men to arrive and, you know, choose them, right? But really, they had to make the choice to choose themselves, which sounds really cliche or whatever, but still, that's what it was. So I think that overall message of, like, don't settle, choose yourself, has remained strong. And it, reading this, I was just like, this is all the shit that I am dealing with as a 40-plus woman. You know, the women at this point are, like, 35 and 36, but it's like, this is all the stuff that I am still dealing with as a single woman dating. And I was like, this is just, will this ever change? Like, I don't know, will this ever change? So I also appreciated that even though it kind of left me a little frustrated and feeling a little hopeless, that there's still like this, I don't want to say a record, but still like this kind of example that what I'm going through is not new, is not special to me. It is something that a lot of women, especially if there were women who date men, especially if they're Black women who date Black men or just date men, period. It's just like, we have to like deal with a lot of this stuff. So I really appreciated getting, even though, like I said, it left me very frustrated and a little hopeless, but I just enjoyed this confirmation that I was not alone in these, some of these really awkward experiences with dating.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like, I feel like through recent history, there's this idea that comes up a lot about women being independent and strong and all of that. And I was thinking as I was reading this book, is that something that has come from Waiting to Exhale? Like, is that part of the legacy of this book as opposed to this book being in a tradition of something? Like, you know, nowadays we see so many things of like, I don't need him, I can go do this on my own, like all the Savannah stuff. And I wonder, like, was Terry McMillan one of the leaders of that, at least in modern culture? I don't know, but
that's a really interesting question because have you read any of her other books?
I haven't. No, this is my first.
No, that's okay. So like some of her other books, like Disappearing Act, which was, is it Axe or Axe? Disappearing Act, which was also made into a movie with Sanaa Lathan and Wesley Snipes.
Oh.
That was not a very, I guess you could say, a very feminist text.
Okay.
And it was not a very feminist movie because, I guess, spoiler alert, like the situation between those characters whose names I can't remember right now, but this couple, it was a really toxic situation. And at the end, they are still, there is this ambiguity, but it's clear that they are still like together in a particular kind of way.
Right.
And then there was some other, oh gosh, what was another book that she did? Basically it was kind of swallow yourself, you know, and just deal with, you know, a bad relationship, which I don't know. So I'm wondering if maybe that is why Waiting to Exhale took off in the way that it did, because it was a little different from some of her other work. So I don't know necessarily that I would say that she created a blueprint or that people are following it, because I think at that time in the 90s, I think a lot of Black women were just going through, you know, from what I can remember, like my, you know, my mom and like older relatives and stuff like that, and just watching a lot of TV and everything. I think a lot of people were just trying to figure out, oh, I don't want to be a wife and mom, you know, I don't want to be a stay-at-home mom. And, you know, they were trying to like regain control of their lives in a particular way. Mm. And so this book and the movie just kind of came at the right time. And it, you know, I don't want to say it created the a revolution, but I think it gave permission for your own internal revolution. If
that's sort of what I was getting at, is like, that she, maybe not all of her books or even Terry McMillan herself, but like that this text became sort of the blueprint for like, I can do my own thing if I want to. Like, I don't have to be with a man. Like, there's other options for me. Mm-hmm. But the other like historical context of this book, which I found interesting, is the book comes out in 1992. 1995, the movie comes out. And then in 1996, Oprah starts her book club. And I feel like Black women reading publicly becomes a thing. And I don't know. I know Black women have always read, you know, like that. I'm not suggesting that that's the case at all. But I do think that like the Terry McMillan of it all and the Oprah of it all. And of course, Toni Morrison is the first book club pick. And there's like sort of this public moment to maybe to outsiders, like people who aren't Black women, that, oh, Black women read and tell stories and all of this stuff. And I just find that to be very interesting, too. I don't know what it is, but like, it feels like there's something there, you know?
Yes, absolutely. Because I remember reading a statistic that said Black women are the biggest group of readers. Yep.
Black college educated women. Yep.
Yes. Yes.
I saw that.
And
too.
So it was at this point, you know, there are always these waves when people realize, oh, Black people like this thing, we should cash in on it, right? Mm-hmm, and so the 90s was a big Black literature boom, even though, like you said, Black people have always been reading and writing, but there was like this wave, you know, Black TV, Black movies, Black books. And so that's when you were getting stuff like Terry McMillan, this author, I think her name was Mary Monroe. She would write books like God Don't Like Ugly and God Still Don't Like Ugly and things like that. So you had a lot of like contemporary churchy fiction that wasn't necessarily like inspirational, but just still, you know, was like, this is for people who go to Black churches, right? That kind of stuff. And then, you know, that was like also when like Elin Harris, oh gosh, Eric Jerome Dickey, Sister Soulja. So those, you know, those were like big, those waves were definitely starting. And so Oprah, I guess, you know, seeing the success of the book to the movie, and she was just like, you know, she, her people, whatever, and her team were just like, let's do this. You know, we have to. That's another thing. I just think the country just follows Black women. We are trendsetters.
1,000%.
And they just follow us. So these are also Black romance was finally getting, and because I know you don't read, romance, but Black romance was at that time starting to pop in a really specific way. So yes, so everything you just said, it was a very obvious kind of like progression of people trying to cash in on what Black people were buying and watching and reading and listening to. So for sure.
Yeah. I mean, and that I definitely feel like in the last 5 or 10 years, we're certainly seeing that again in Black culture. Like I feel like the art that's coming out, the, you know, quote unquote mainstream things, like, I mean, people are obsessed with us. What can I say?
They should be.
Yeah. I mean, like, imagine American, quote unquote, American culture without Black people. It would be a wreck.
Yeah.
A real wreck. Okay. I want to talk about one of the things that I think aged horribly in this book. But I don't think it's Terry McMillan's fault. I think it was a sign of the times, which is the homophobia AIDS stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, man. And again, the book was written in 1992. It's about 1990. And I know and understand very well that at the time, people were terrified of AIDS. They didn't understand it. They knew the wrong things, you know, like they were told the wrong things. So like, I don't necessarily think that Terry McMillan is homophobic or whatever. I just think that at the time, as a group, everyone was homophobic, very generalizing, you know, but like the hairdresser assistant who has AIDS, oh my God. And then the dad of Tariq, who comes out as gay and was like, I used to be bi, but now I'm gay. And like Tariq's whole, you know, use of the F word, like, holy cow. I was sitting at my seat, like, can I just be finished with this part? Like, it was so hard to read.
It was really, really bad to the point that we would see Gloria in the salon with the hairdressers, I would just kind of skim because I was so uncomfortable with the portrayal of the male hairdressers. And Tariq, you know, in the movie, he gets portrayed as kind of like, oh, he's just a teenager being difficult. But he was really awful to his mom, you know, with the fat shaming and then just making her feel like crap about, you know, when the dad comes out and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I agree with you 100%. Also, like that whole thing of like, I was bi, but now I'm gay. That is such an old stereotype that, you know, by erasure, where people are just like, no, you have to be one or the other. You can't, and you know, you can't be bi at all. This is just being bi is like a stepping stone to what you really want or whatever, which is just really awful. The other thing about this is like reading this now with the knowledge of Terry, and I know sometimes you're supposed to really like separate the author from the book, but you reading this now with the knowledge of what happened with Terry McMillan's personal life with her husband and that relationship that was the basis of how Stella got her groove back. And then it turned out that her husband, or now ex-husband, that he was gay or, you know, or queer. I don't know how he identified, but he, you know, eventually came out and there was a lot of nastiness, you know, around that. So I'm just like, again, just, what's going on with Miss McMillan? Like what, like, I don't want to call her homophobic, but definitely stuff in here was not very flattering. And it's really hard for me to know if it's just the text or if that's her putting some of her own thoughts into the text. You know what I mean? Cause like you have bad characters. That doesn't necessarily mean that you are a bad person because you're writing these bad characters, right? And when I say bad, I mean like morally and ethically bad. But it really that was another thing that made me uncomfortable. Like I said, I was skimming over some of the stuff because I cannot read how she's talking about these people. Like this is, you know, how she's writing these people.
Right.
This is really ugly and unnecessary, honestly. It was definitely, you know, leftover stuff from the AIDS scare of the 80s, and people were trying to make sense of AIDS and how to navigate the world with AIDS in the 90s and what, you know, what that means to be around people with AIDS and how do you protect yourself and all that kind of stuff. But it was just really uncomfortable.
One of the things that you actually just made me think that I sort of want to reframe what I said before, which is that I don't know that everyone or most people were homophobic necessarily, but I think books like this and a lot of like public portrayal and, you know, the words from the Reagans and, you know, I think that that leads to distortion of history, maybe for someone like me who was younger in the 90s, early 90s, where I think that everyone was like that because that's what I see. But I just want to acknowledge that I know there were plenty of people in the 80s and 90s who were not homophobic, who understood how HIV and AIDS worked. And, you know, if not for those people doing the work that they were doing and living the lives that they were living and being the people that they were, I think, you know, they get erased for these narratives of like, oh, we used to be homophobic, just like people get erased of like, oh, we used to be racist. You know, like I want to just acknowledge those people because what I said before is not fully accurate. And I don't want to, I just want to acknowledge those people.
Yeah.
Okay, let's take a quick break and then we'll be right back. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated. And AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in store. And now save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Okay, we're back. I want to talk about another set of stereotypes that have not aged well, but felt like, holy shit, how 90s is this? Of like, Black men ain't shit / bitter Black women. Like, the thing about the book that's interesting to me, and like we both touched on from the beginning, is the book sort of holds up great. And then also when you break it down, sort of holds up horribly. Like, like there's so many things to pick out to be like, that doesn't hold up, that doesn't hold up, that doesn't hold up, which I think is partially like pop culture. Like, I don't know that pop culture holds up great over time because it is so specific, like to that moment necessarily, give or take some things. But when I watched the movie, I watched it with my brother and his wife. And my brother was like, damn, ain't these some bitter black women? And I was like, right? Like the whole book and the whole movie, when you boil it down, is like sort of horrible. Like,
yeah, I So I was thinking about that because I was like, is this supposed to be a caricature? Like, is this supposed to, I don't think it's necessarily supposed to be satire, but like everyone was so, the depictions of men when they were bad were so outsized. They were so dramatically bad. You know what I mean? So even like,
who's Robin's boyfriend who's like on crack or doing cocaine or whatever?
Right. Tim, then, you know, every guy is cheating.
Russell's a baby daddy moment. We have Savannah's guy who's a rich, fancy doctor who's cheating. Like,
right. Everyone that Savannah seems like was interested in was cheating. Yeah. And, you know, even when she, like, she goes through a list of the guys that she's been seeing over the last few years, they're just all terrible, right? You know? And even when she's talking about like her sister's husband, he's awful and her sister wants to leave him constantly. I wonder if we're supposed to like see so much of the bitterness and it's just like really hammered into our head so that we can finally be like, oh, we should treat black women with care.
Yeah. You know? I want to give it that kind of like generous reading for sure. You know, like I like want it to be that. I don't want it to be the like caricature version, but it's hard to balance. I think maybe also because the book is like recent but old, you know, like it still feels so relevant. So it doesn't feel like, I don't know, it's harder for me to give it like a historical reading because it feels like, you know, it's in our lifetime.
Because I remember when, I don't necessarily remember when the book came out, but I remember when The Color Purple, the film came out, and a lot of black men were very upset at the portrayals of black men in that movie because they were like, there's no positive portrayal of black men in this movie. And so I don't remember it clearly because I was too young for that, but I do remember like this lasting trail of discussions about positive images of black men in media. Like, where are they? How can we get them? What does it mean when black women are not putting out positive images and stuff like that and all this kind of stuff? And so bringing up this discussion and thinking about this, I'm also thinking about the stereotypes of like black men leaving black women for white women.
Sure, of course.
So when Bernadine's husband leaves her or a white woman, and it is just over and over, they keep saying, John left her. And then there's a pause. And then it's for a white girl. And then it's just like, that's even worse. Like, that is, you know, it's not a bad, like, him leaving is bad, but him leaving her for a white girl is even worse. And it doesn't even matter that she's younger, you know, which would probably be the thing that some people would focus on. Oh, you know, he's leaving for a 24-year-old. Mm-hmm. But because she's white, then that's like the super focus. And it's just like, I think it's this, it reinforces this idea, black women doing so much work and then it, you know, getting so much work in the home and then it getting like shifted, the credit gets shifted or like the rewards get shifted to somebody else. And, you know, that was just a lot in the book. And I've forgotten how much that like they'd hammered down on the race stuff. And it was not very nuanced at all.
No, not at all. But again, that's what's like so interesting to me about this book, because if this book came out now, I would be like, this book is not good. You know, like it's full of all of these things that are not good. But I liked the book and I liked the way that it made me think about history and like the way, like the cultural conversation and the shifts. And I don't know, I feel like maybe I'm being like an apologist or something. I don't know. But like, I enjoyed reading it and thinking as I was reading, like, oh, damn. Or like, oh, that's interesting. And I think that the women hold up. A lot around the women don't hold up. But I think the women,
the four women, they, for the most part, you know, aside from some homophobia, fatphobia, like horribleness, they hold up as humans. And I think that that's probably the core of the book, that when the book came out in 1992, all the way till now, is what folks connected with, right? Like the four of them.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that's a really good point, because I think if like someone who is 20s to 25, who has no frame of reference for the 90s at all, reads this now, they're just going to be like, this book is awful.
Yeah.
You know, or even if you were alive during that time and you're just now reading it, but you didn't have the experience of being like a Black person in the 90s or a Black person in a major city in the 90s, you would just, and you're reading it now, it would not go over well. So I do think that maybe my reading now, my impression of it has been softened by the fact that I remember that time. And so it's easier for me to like place myself in that time period and be like, okay, I remember that the 90s were not the most progressive. I mean, we were trying, but you know, obviously it's not like it is now. But that's what I meant like earlier, like the women were, they're still the heart, the meat of the text is still really good. And I think Terry McMillan did a really good job of giving us these very strong characters, even individually, like if you pulled them out of their friendship, you know, of their connecting and friendship, and they were just like, and the book was just a collection of stories for each of them, I think that they would stand on their own very well.
Yeah.
But the connective tissue is still really strong and bonding.
Yeah. And I think also like the other thing that we haven't talked about that I think holds up really well is the female friendship, right? Like the bond between Black women to be there for one another through it all and not to be related, right? Like, I think we know that, I mean, I don't know, I know this in my personal experience in my family with my Black relatives and all of that, is that like Black families are very strong units and oftentimes are very connected with like cousins and this and that. And sometimes they're not actually blood related and all of that stuff. But the chosen family as well is like so important, I think, for Black women specifically, because of all of these stereotypes that we get in the book, right? Like because of all these reasons and things that go wrong and all of that, like seeing their friendship really, I mean, it's super moving. Like I think the support of Black women for one another is one of the most beautiful, powerful, incredible things. And just like Color Purple, like reading it and seeing it. And I just, I find that to be super, super moving.
Yeah. And one of the things that I picked up on this time around was how the women pampered themselves and did the whole like self-care thing before we were calling it self-care and like the beauty rituals of the women. You know, obviously hair was still a big thing. Hair is always going to be a big thing for Black women. And so, even though there was like, again, just kind of like this narrow-minded view of like women who wore weaves and stuff like that and whatever, but there's still that, what it means when you change your appearance and you are trying something new and you are giving yourself care in a particular way through your beauty regimen. So I really enjoy like picking up on that aspect through it. And then there was like one more thing that I was like, Bernadine's daughter is named Onika. And I was like, I don't know if Onika is a common name in Trinidad and Tobago, where Nicki Minaj is from, but that is Nicki Minaj's real name. Her first name is Onika, spelled the exact same way. And I am wondering if she was named after.
Do we know what year she was born?
I don't know.
Okay, I'm going to Google it right now.
Thank you.
Okay, Nicki Minaj was born in 1982, so no.
Oh, no. Okay,
Dang.
Never mind.
That would have been really great, though.
I know, right? But I wonder, now I'm wondering where that name comes from.
That was definitely like that moment in the 90s, too, where it was like, oh, we're giving children African names, like, right? Do you remember that was like such a thing? Like half of my friends had like, you know, names like the son, like John. And then half of my friends had like African or like indigenous names. And I thought that that's like such a reference in the movie for sure, or in the book for sure.
Mm-hmm. Just kind of like this reclamation of history and ethnicity.
Yeah. And the fucking husband, John, like hating all the black things and like that self-loathing black, you know, OJ Simpson-y vibe, right? Like where it's like, I don't have any black things in my house. I'm going to marry this white woman. Like that's like such a caricature. Not that John is a murderer. I just, you know, that he was, he's one of the most prominent 90s anti-black, black people. I feel like OJ well known for that.
Yeah. So that was another thing that I was like, oh, I'd forgotten about this. But that's something that's still, I don't know if it's necessarily prevalent or really if it ever was, but this idea that black people's upward mobility is predicated upon them, their distance between their blackness.
Yeah.
And so that was, you know, obviously a very strong commentary.
Yeah. I feel like that's shifting. That's shifting for sure. Like, I think there's that reclamation of like, I can be black as I want to be and I can be successful. But I definitely think in the 90s, that was a thing.
For sure. Yeah.
Oh, wait, one more thing that has aged well, and then we'll get off this. Robin's obsession with like crystals and astrology and stuff. Like, Robin, hello. Like, because back in the 90s, that was like super woo woo stuff. Now there's like everyone. I mean, I live in LA, so that might be part of my understanding, but I feel like everyone knows their rising sign, you know, like everyone is like into that. Like, when I got pregnant, my friend was like, oh, well, what will your children's sign be? It's very important. I was like, well, I don't know. Gonna find out.
Yes, and it's interesting because that stuff was kind of used to characterize her as like an airhead or someone
or like cuckoo.
They shouldn't take very seriously, and like, you know, she is portrayed as like the silly, tacky person or whatever, and really she's just, like, all of them just wanted to be loved. They just want love and they want clarity in their life. And, you know, Poor Robin.
Robin would do so well in 2021, I feel.
Absolutely.
I feel like Bernie probably wouldn't do great in 2021, but I feel like Robin would thrive right now.
I think so, too. I think so, too. And I think Gloria will be good.
Gloria would be fine.
She would be fine.
And Savannah would, of course, be thriving. I feel like Savannah's going to thrive wherever she is.
Yeah.
Okay, the last thing we always talk about is cover and title. I think you and I have the same cover with like the woman looking out the window.
Yeah.
But there's also the black title or the black cover with like the four dancing women.
And yes.
Yeah, that's the one my mom had when I was growing up. I couldn't find her copy. I think she got rid of it. But the cover of this with like the woman gazing out the window at the tree is like truly, it's just a nothing to me. Like, I'm like, okay.
Like, yes,
this does not look like the book at all. I think you need four people on the cover. And this is just like, I don't know.
I completely agree with you again on this, because I was like, this just looks like basic women's fiction. I mean, I guess that's what this book is categorized as, is women's fiction.
Right.
But it just looks so generic. And I was looking for a copy of the book with the black cover and the art on it. And so I was looking at used stores online, but it was a little expensive, or more than I wanted to pay at the time. Because that, like you, that's the one that my mom had, the hardback with the cover. And I remember that that also launched this particular prominence of black art, like kind of abstract black art at the time. And everybody was going out getting that. I remember that, if not that artist, but then other art like it being used for in magazines and all these other places. And it was like a sign of being bougie if you had that art in your house and everything, if you got a print like it. But yeah, I think it needs the four women represented on the cover. That's important because it's like, I don't know who this is supposed to be on the cover of this one. And there's even another cover that I saw that was even more generic and bland.
Yes, I saw that one too. I can't remember it, but I saw the third cover. I was like, wait, what?
Yeah. So So I don't know.
I don't know who's in charge of the covers, but they need to get it together.
Yeah. And then this cover has, and I understand this because this is usually what happens when you get to a certain level in publishing, but your name is much bigger than the mm-hmm. title. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like the title should be bigger.
Yeah.
Or at least the same size.
I agree. I wonder if it's also because they wanted it to be all on one line. Because then do you do waiting to exhale, or do you do like waiting to exhale, or do you do wait it like, or do you waiting to exhale? Like, I don't know. The title itself, I feel like it comes up early in the book. It comes up on like page 17 in our copy. And it's Savannah talking about like wanting to finally like be able to relax a little bit in life and feel like comfortable where she is. And then she exhales when she's like with the weird guy who sells the fire trucks when they're dancing or whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. He was a real psycho. I really didn't like him. I was so glad he was gone. But I don't know. I like the title. I don't know that I needed an explanation in the text. Like, it didn't move me much when I got to that part, or like it happens a few other times. I think Bernie exhales. Maybe they all exhale at some point.
Yeah, I think that was a little overkill. I understand why it had to happen, but I do agree that it could have, I don't know, maybe there was a softer way to do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else you want to say about this book, Nicole?
No, I don't think so. There was another line, like maybe on the first page, that Savannah says, there's a big difference between being thirsty and being dehydrated. And again, I think that just goes, this speaks to the larger thing of don't settle. And like, you know, you can have a need, but you don't, maybe it's not as pressing as you think it is, you know, and kind of looking out for yourself and taking care of yourself in a particular way. But I thought that was funny. There are a lot of, the humor of this book.
Yes.
Again, it's kind of wrapped in that fat phobia and the homophobia. But when it's away from those two things, the humor in the book is really sharp, I think. And it's not like, you know, a knee slapping mm-hmm. kind of funny, but it's definitely just like a little thing that makes you chuckle to yourself. So I think that kind of that stays, you know, that has aged fairly well. Again, if it's not connected to those two major issues.
Right. It sort of works. I agree. There's definitely a good humor. And like, also the book just feels really Black, which I like. Like, it doesn't feel like she's writing it for white audiences at all. And that's cool, because I feel like so many authors, at least now, are concerned about like being mainstream enough, or like their editors or their agents or whatever are telling them like, this won't sell, you need to change it. And like, this book didn't really feel like that. Like, it felt like she was like, I'm writing this book for Black women, and like, this is it. Thanks.
Yeah. That's one of the things. I think we've stepped away from the term own voices now, from my understanding. But that's one of the things that that bothered me, is that it seemed like a lot of these books were explaining stuff to their white audiences, or they were like, you know, there was just a lot of like, this is my culture, this is a cultural thing that we do, and here's why, you know. And I'm just like, just say it. You don't have to explain it, because like what we talked about earlier, we can go look up something, you know, we have the means to look that up. But yes, this book was just definitely for Black women with, if you get it, you get it, and you just keep it moving.
1,000%. Okay, everybody, I think that will wrap up our conversation today with Nicole. Before we get out of here, I just want to remind you to check out Nicole's book. It is a memoir in essays. Is that what you call it? A memoir in essays? That's what I call it.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I've been calling it. So
yeah,
good job on you. You wrote something that I can classify. It's called Sometimes I Trip on How Happy We Could Be. It's named after a Prince song, not a Beyonce song. You can find Nicole on the internet. She's on Twitter. She's on Instagram. She's got a great website. It's all linked in the show notes. But do check out Nicole's book. Nicole, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for giving me a reason to go back to this book. As you know, as problematic as it is in parts, it was still really refreshing and nice to reread it.
I agree. I'm glad I finally read it. So thank you. And everybody else, we will see you in the stacks. All right, that does it. Thank you all for listening. And thank you to Nicole for being my guest. I am thrilled to announce that in November, we will continue our journey through Toni Morrison's novels with Song of Solomon. We will be discussing the book on Wednesday, November 24th, and you can tune in next Wednesday to find out who our guest will be for that conversation. If you love the show and want inside access to it, head to patreon.com/thestacks to join the Stacks Pack. Make sure you're subscribed to the Stacks wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave us a rating and a review. For more from the Stacks, follow us on social media at the Stacks Pod on Instagram and at the Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. Our editor is Christian Duenas. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite. And our theme music is from Tagirages. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.